If you've bought property, you likely funded your purchase partly through a mortgage. If the property increases in value over time by more than the cost of the borrowing, you're better off. In the stock market, using debt is often called gearing. The new BetaShares Wealth Builder Funds, ASX ticker symbols G200 and GHHF, offer moderate gearing across Australian and global shares for investors who are comfortable with the higher risks associated with gearing their investments. You can discover how they work by visiting betashares.com.au. Please don't forget that gearing magnifies gains and losses, so read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer.
This is a podcast by the Rask Group. It's for educational purposes only. So please do not make a financial, legal, investment or taxation decision based on solely what you hear in this show.
Welcome to the Australian Property Podcast.
We're on a mission to be Australia's most trusted property podcast.
I'm Owen Rask, founder of the Rask Group.
I'm Pete Borgen, author and buyer's agent.
I'm Amy Linardi, and I am a buyer's agent.
I'm Chris Bates, ex-financial planner and mortgage broker.
Together, we'll take you through every step of your property journey.
From first home buyer to decades of property investing.
G'day, welcome to the Australian Property Podcast. I'm Pete Borgen from Alan Borgen Property Buyers. This week, a big story or big topic to cover. This is how to build an eight-figure property portfolio with Stephen Ash. So, Steve, welcome. It's great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Pete. Happy to go through some of my stories, trials and tribulations of property investing.
Really want to drill into this today because what I want to cover is what you've done well, what didn't work out so well. But in particular, if you were starting out from scratch today, what would you do? And can it still be done today? So I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit as well. So looking forward to it. So obviously, I can hear a fellow English accent there. So tell us a bit about your background, where you're from, and what kind of schooling you did, and then what you ended up doing for professional career.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I'm from the motherland. So I've been in Australia now for 17 or 18 years, I think it is now, and lived in three cities. So started in Sydney, but I didn't do the Bondi route as most POMs do. Sort of kind of went down south to Cobra, then a few years in Melbourne. I've been in Brisbane now for the last 6 years or so. So I grew up in a town called Reading, which is about 30 miles west of London, and did all my schooling there. It's good fun. So growing up with the family, I did go to a private school, but I didn't actually, perform very well at school. I just focused a lot on sort of sport back then, so playing cricket and football, and sort of like that's taken me sort of to university. I sort of didn't work as hard as I should have done. I actually ended up doing a sports science degree, which is quite interesting, which I'd laugh about now, especially where my career's gone. And I sort of took that and started to work actually in the leisure industry. And I kind of worked out pretty soon that there wasn't much sort of career sort of like progress here. So I retrained to sort of IT as a lot of people did, sort of around the 2000 mark. And I got lucky and I found myself working in finance a few years of that, working on a sort of IT service application support desk. And I sort of grew that career and now I started working for HSBC in London. So, and that's really where my career sort of progressed. And I came across to Australia. I've been working at some of the biggest investment banks since, and I've been working now for some of the biggest superannuation funds. So it's been quite a fun career so far. But that's really my background in a couple of minutes.
There's a few familiar strands there. I think a lot of new arrivals to Australia initially go to Sydney because that's where they know, that's where the main employment hubs are, the biggest employers. But internally, people tend to move to Southeast Queensland. You've kind of followed that route. And I see today you're a buyer's agent and property strategist, and I'll let people know where to go in the show notes and we can talk about that a bit at the end. And also, I guess like a lot of people are not 100% sure what you want to do. You sort of go to where the money and the opportunities are. In Australia, mining, IT, finance, that kind of thing. What was your career like and how did you get into property? Because I guess from what you're saying, you're not from a real estate type of background, but you've obviously moved in that direction. So tell us a bit about that journey.
Well, yeah, sure. So I mean, the start was really trying to sort of grow the career. And it was actually sort of a chance encounter when I was in London and I was working sort of on the trade for one of the guys there said, you can't, put all your eggs on the career basket. You need other irons in the fire. And I always remember that one. You always need other irons in the fire. So I always kept that at the back of my mind. And when I came out to Sydney, I mean, it was just more about trying to settle. So I was lucky enough to get sponsored by a big US bank called State Street. And so it was pretty good getting involved in there. And that sort of exposed me sort of like to the investment world and kind of how sort of like the FX and the equity traders were sort of building portfolios. But so I kind of had an idea. I've come to Australia, but I really want to get on the property ladder. So I was pretty gung-ho when I first got here. I was on the 457 visa and I just decided, I'm not going to rent for forever. So I 6 months, I remember breaking the lease there pretty quickly and then buying my first property down in Corbera, it was, in 2007. And I had to do this BURB approval. So because it was an established dwelling. So that was a bit of drama trying to get that done. A lot of people saying, oh, you're crazy just buying Bondi or Balmain or wherever that was. But there was some method behind the madness in going down to Cobra. And so that was, I think, 6 to 9 months into my Australia journey, I got straight onto the ladder. And I suppose it was a little bit by accident, but why I did that. But then all of a sudden it just started, sparking a seed. On what could be done. So I kept focusing on the career, but then I started reading some magazines and looking at the Summersoft Forum, which is quite, there wasn't much, didn't have your podcast back then, Peter, or other things, but that's how I started developing my knowledge along with my career. The other thing I might add, I mean, I was quite interested in stock back then. What I wanted to do, taking that other irons in the fire sort of concept, I needed to do something. Because I couldn't just rely on sort of like the career to retire. So stock I did have a look at, but because of my position sort of like in the investment banks and having access to sort of see the order flow and stuff and all the compliance that goes around that, I just thought it was too much hassle than it was worth. And so that's what attracted me to property. And I started connecting with a few people and I learned a lot from those people. So that's really kind of how it started really. And I think being in that investment sort of industry, or background, if you will, kind of inspires you to sort of like look at your own journey. So I knew I needed to do something else, and that's how it all started, basically.
So if you work in financial services, there's sometimes a limitation on what you can invest in a stock market, yes. Or sometimes you have to disclose all your holdings, which isn't always ideal. How do your work colleagues know what your property and stock portfolio is invested in? And it can actually get quite difficult trying to keep track of what you can and can't invest in and when you can do it. At least with real estate, you don't have those same conflicts potentially. So did you have a strategy when you started out, or was it more a case of learn as you go along? Because as you mentioned, these days there's stacks of information, but I think back to even, there was a few chat forums, I guess, 20 years ago. And before that, there was kind of the how to become a landlord guides, but they were so dry. They were very much in terms of the process, there was books that sort of explained the hows and whats of becoming a landlord, but they were almost undigestible. Whereas now there's YouTube, there's books, and Jan Summers wrote an excellent couple of books in Australia for people to follow the path. So did you have a strategy when you started out, or was it a case of learn as you go along? So I guess 2007 was a bit of a hairy time, just globally and in the economy as well.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought up the Jan Summers book. I think that's a Bible for a lot of people who started off. I mean, that's just so straightforward, just reading that and what it can be. But what it really was so we fumbled into this property. I remember, into Corogra, I was pounding the pavements, looked at about 50, and then you could just sort of see value when you got it into Corogra. So we bought that for about 442 in 2007. And then a year later, it was valued about 580, I think it was. And so that was when the light bulb moment sort of hit. But I was, you know, a little bit scared to take action. So I just started educating myself. And so I didn't actually do anything for a couple of years or 3 years. One of the reasons was that I didn't do the finance right. I went straight to a bank. It was St. George from memory. And then the bank manager put me into a fixed term, so I couldn't break the loan. So I kind of had to sort of see that 3 year sort of fixed period out. And so during that time, I sort of educated myself. And after 3 years, my wife and I decided to buy a principal place of residence in Balcombe Hills. And then we saw that Cobra was worth $600,000. And we thought, oh yeah, we kind of like made loads of money, which we had back then, about $150,000. So we were quite excited about that. So we're going to sell that and, sort of buy the property in Balcombe Hills and pay the debt down. But my broker, the guy like back then who had a very sizable investment portfolio, said, well, don't do that. Just rent out the Gorgora property, keep the Balcombe Hills property, and then you're good to go. And so that's really the genesis of the property portfolio. So we did that. He structured the loans correctly. We sort of pulled up the LVR and covered it up to 80%, rented that out. And then we had a property portfolio with one property. And so that was kind of like, I don't know, the sliding doors moment really sort of in my life, because that really sort of opened up the prospect of this is how easy it is to start building the portfolio and getting the structure right. And then really we sort of like accelerated from there. But that was the big first moment when it all hit off.
Pretty common story, isn't it? I think a lot of people buy their first unit or flat on their own, and then they partner up with somebody else who's maybe done the same thing, and then they look to buy jointly. And I'd say this was exactly my journey. You know, we had a place each, and then we decided to move in together, and we bought the place jointly. And then without really planning to have done so, you've ended up with a few properties, and then you think, oh, actually, this is kind of working okay. I think, as you said, I can remember, because I played a lot of adult sports as a very young man, like a lot of my friends were 10, 15 years older, and I'd see some of them selling their homes, maybe a relationship breakdown, and getting a massive windfall of cash. And it's a bit of an eye-opener when you think how hard it is to save money, but then you see the equity being created through simple ownership of property, and it can sort of move you in that direction. So, and then from that point, was it then that you looked to start building out a portfolio as an investor, or to actually actively choose to become a landlord?
That's exactly it. And we did take that forward. And I remember going out sort of like, it's about 2011 or so, out to Blacktown and places where you could have picked up properties on 600-700 square meters for $300,000. It sounds crazy back then, but now I should say, so we're trying to work out what to do. And there was a bit of, you know, overthinking it or whatever. And so we actually used a buyer's agent and to propel us forward. We didn't actually have a plan at this point. And so we did buy a property out in West Sydney in a place called North St. Mary's. And that was really kind of that, you know, jumping on getting on the journey, the property journey to start building the portfolio. And that's kind of when we did that. And then we were kind of working with a buyer's agent back then. I was very busy in my job. And we started, and he was trying to push us into different directions. And this is kind of like maybe the second big moment, really, that I had to sit down with my accountant then, who's a K-Shab Partners. The guy's name's Manzoor Khan. He's been a very successful investor. And he sat me down and he basically said, well, what are you trying to do? And I just thought, well, I'm just trying to get as many cash flow properties as I can and just see where we go. And this is kind of where we sat down. We actually thought about a plan and what we could do. And really that kind of like started with the end in sight. So, okay, so what do you want to do? Well, I want to get $100,000 passive income. Okay, so to get $100,000 passive income, you need $2 million worth of property at, say, yield of 5%. And then you need a paid up principal place of residence. So you probably need about $2.6 million to cover the loan on Balcombe Hills, and then $2 million uncovered property. And so that was the start of the strategy. And then we had the one investment property, and that was kind of what we were then going to try and emulate sort of as time went on. So that was the importance of having a plan and a property strategy, started back then. So that was my plan and how I was going to do it.
It makes sense. I think even somebody been really enthusiastic about real estate over the years. I still have used buyer's agents, and sometimes that can help to cut through the noise just to give you the options. Yeah, what are my choices here in this price point? And that can help. I sometimes bought myself and sometimes used buyer's agents. There's pros and cons. What were the things that worked really well? And on the flip side, is there anything that didn't work quite so well or were not as planned?
Yeah, no. It can go into that. And this is kind of where sort of the journey for myself goes a little bit off track a little bit. And I think you mentioned Jan Summers' book a few minutes ago, and that's really kind of like property investing is simple, but it's not easy. And because you get caught up in other things. So where we went off track a little bit, so the buyer's agent we're working with there, you know, I think West Sydney was a good place, and we wanted to keep buying in West Sydney, but kind of like he was talking about, you know, regional, buying regional Australia and sort of places like Townsville and Cairns. And so we're a little bit, you know, not too sure, but we thought, well, we'll give it a go. And so I think that was probably the first mistake. And when I look at the business model back then, they shouldn't have done that. And so that's one thing, sort of buying regional without really knowing what you're doing, just trying to chase the yield rather than staying in the major CBDs. That was really the first big mistake that we made, but that was an easy one to correct. We didn't sort of put too much capital up there, so no big mistake. The second one was, well, I was talking about just the same broker who kind of who encouraged us to sort of help us like rent out that first property, kind of like it just talked about doing small subdivisions, etc. So you buy a bit of land, you know, build a couple out the back, subdivide, then not be, you know, sell a couple off and then pay down the debt on the other one. Sounds so simple on paper. And so we thought, okay, that sounds, you know, a lot very sensible to us. And at that particular time, Sydney was growing quite a bit, and we thought there was quite a bit of opportunity down in Melbourne. So we went and bought a place down in Melbourne in a place called Pascoe Vale South, which is about 6-7 km, I think, north of Melbourne CBD. And the idea there was to subdivide and then build at the back. Probably didn't do enough due diligence then, and we thought that we could rent the main property out when we were doing the plans, but as it turned out, it was a bit of a wreck and we couldn't do anything, so we had the holding costs. So while it was a good area, just trying to chase that sexy sort of strategy of development or small subdivision was another sort of like strategy that didn't go so well for us. So we held that for a couple of years, did the plans, ready to go, could have got the finance, and then work just exploded for me. I was working for one of the real top investment banks then, and I just thought, well, I had a baby on the way. I just thought the easiest thing to do is just sell this with the plans. And we lost a little bit of money. But that was kind of really the first two big mistakes I think I made in property.
It's a really interesting point. I'd like to drill down on a little bit. I was going to say double click, but I don't usually say things like that. Industry jargon. It's an interesting point whether people who are busy in their professional career should take on a property development. I mean, because I've seen for a lot of people, what they can manage is they buy a property that's not quite right and maybe put in a new kitchen, maybe a new bathroom or repaint or new carpets or just a cosmetic rejuvenation. That seems to be comfortably manageable for a lot of people, and they try to add $2 for every dollar spent, maybe try and add a couple of dollars value. But on the other hand, I've seen people, as you mentioned there, they take on a property development and then they, because they're not full-time committed to doing it, they end up with cost overruns, or they're too busy in their career, or there's a change to lending settings, or there's a recession, or something makes it not work out. And sometimes people get two or three successful developments under their belt, but the third one doesn't work. Or, you know, there's obviously a range of risks there to be managed. Do you think for the average person, because what I'm trying to get to the heart of here is if somebody's just starting out their journey today, Should that be something they look at doing to accelerate the journey, or would they be better off buying something that's maybe got future potential to subdivide or renovate, but not actually do it themselves? What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it's a very, very good question, very good point. I personally, having been through this sort of process a couple of times, I think when you start out, just start out simple And it's those bread and butter sort of properties near the maybe, you know, a CBD near the median, maybe under the median, as a bit of cash flow. I think they're the ones that perform a lot better. And I just give a bit of an example sort of comparing the two, because it, I mean, the subdivision development, I mean, it's obviously very sexy, sounds good, you know, potential for massive upside. Don't get me wrong, there is. But I think you do need to do your kind of like, you know, your time in the trenches, if you will, or just keep it straightforward. So we tried to do it again in another sort of, in Melbourne again. So I don't know, we were cursed with Melbourne, but yeah, don't think about that too much. So north in Reservoir, and we did plans for 5 townhouses. It looked great on paper. But when we had a look at it, we could have made, I think it was about a 15% margin in there. Then you'd factor in GST and selling costs and everything. So we met with this same dilemma we're talking about. And that's really when I sort of had a real sit down. I remember actually up in your neck of the woods, Noosa, a few years ago, and just really thinking about what we're doing. And then I looked at the opportunity cost. I had so much money in this deal. And so I think we had about, yeah, it was $500,000 sort of like just in equity, just in this one property. And we just thought, what if we just buy cash, well, sort of like, you know, vanilla properties near the median, near a CBD, then if we just had pretty good growth, if we buy well, then we can far out see sort of like what you could do with a property development with no risk, and you can get fairly, you know, decent rental returns. And so we pivoted very strongly. We sold the Reservoir property and we bought 5 or 6 just with the proceeds of that, all with a similar sort of brief, just around that median. And that strategy's been very good for us. So just to answer the question, I think that's the context really on what we went through. But I think starting out, just keep it simple. Just buy a good property, rents well, good cash flow, good prospects, and just let time do its thing.
Good. Yeah. Summers in her book talked about buying median price property because the cheaper or most expensive quartiles of the market, they're thinner, I suppose, not as many buyers around, so they're going to be a more volatile journey. Whereas if you kind of stick to the sweet spot around the median price, the demand is more consistent through the cycle because people are always going to want somewhere to live. And if it's affordable to most of the buyers in that market, then that might just make it a more comfortable or smoother journey and a bit less volatile. And yeah, I think you're right. I sometimes see some of these projects where people do a feasibility and they're really thin on detail. And there's not much margin in them sometimes, thinking, oh, you know, 10 or 15% margin, is it worth the risk? You've reminded me with your Pommy insights there. There used to be those TV shows in England with Sarah Beeny where they do a like phenomenally complex developments, and she'd say to the people at the end, you've made 25%, but the market's gone up 23% or something. Like you've added no value to the reno. You could have just done nothing. And you know, quite often it's a happy outcome, but the amount of stress and time and energy involved hasn't been compensated sometimes. And I think it's more the risk. I think if you're going to go down that route, it can certainly accelerate the journey, but you've got to be cognizant of the risk. And we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years how costs can overrun. A lot of construction businesses have gone under on fixed price contracts. So definitely risks to be managed there. And having seen a lot of property strategies and journeys over the years, it's interesting that it usually does take, for most people, it's 2 full property market cycles before people can generate significant wealth. And it seems to have been your experience too, that, yeah, over, as you said, from 2007, you know, it's kind of 17 years there. And then you're really starting to see the fruits of your results over that kind of time.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's not a get-rich-quick sort of journey. And that's why I was saying it's simple but not easy. You just got to keep coming, stepping up, and just doing the little things each day. And that takes care of the big things. And it's hard, you know, because there's a lot out there buying on the market value, all of this sort of stuff. And don't get me wrong, that can be done. But I think people just want to expect sort of like to buy a $500,000 property and then it's $800,000 like in 6 months. But over those long cycles, I mean, if we just take sort of like, you know, the West Sydney property that we bought, 2011, bought that for 240,000, and the value is now 800,000, sort of just 12, 13 years later. So, I mean, that's just quite incredible sort of growth. It's just the wild buying's extremely important. It's generally the waiting, and that's where I've come a cropper before. And that's certainly some of the mistakes I see with other people with property as well.
Impatience, yeah. No, I think the compounding, I was reading the other day how Warren Buffett's made 98% of his wealth after the age of 65, because probably because he's lived into his 90s, but because he's just kept on going. Again, it's the compound growth delivers a lot of power, but it takes time, I suppose, and the longer you can keep it going, the better the snowball becomes. And if you were starting out from scratch today, because again, a lot of people say, yeah, it's okay for you because you started in the 1990s when things were cheaper and da-da-da. But if you were going to try and build an eight-figure portfolio today, firstly, do you think it can still be done? And secondly, if you were starting from scratch, but knowing what you know now, what would you do if you were starting today?
Yeah, well, I believe it certainly can be done. But what I wanted to do is just provide a little bit of context just quickly before I answer that sort of question. So when I started out, I remember clearly my second year in Australia, I was in State Street. I'd sort of just bought the property in Cogra. I was talking to one of the girls I worked with there, and I mentioned I bought this property, and she goes, "What are you doing? Why did you do that?" And I said, "Well, I thought it was pretty good value. I wanted to get on the ladder." "Oh," I said, "Where do you live?" "I live in Manly, but I'm waiting for the property crash. And when the property crash happens, I'm going to go and mop up all of these sort of cheap properties." And I think back then, I think Manly would have been about 700,000 for an apartment or whatever. But anyway, the reason why I'm mentioning that is because that's all I used to hear back then. Is like, well, you know, is this property's grown so much in Sydney in the early 2000s, it can't be replicated. You can't go and look what happened sort of around that 2011 mark. I think it just, price in Sydney just went gangbusters, and so she didn't buy Manly, which I don't think she did. She'd just be renting. So I think starting now, it's just kind of like, hey, where do you start now? Obviously, property prices have appreciated. I'd certainly think that it can be done. The first thing I'd be doing, and this is what I was quite lucky I did it fairly early, is build a good team. And the reason why, I just think it's one of the most important things you can do. So having, I mean, the key persons is your mortgage broker, really. Someone who can look at the finance, look at your setup, and then maybe work with a property strategist, a property strategist and a broker to kind of look at where you're at, and then putting that sort of property strategy to align with what you're doing. And that could be either a cash flow strategy or a capital growth strategy if you want to be a little bit more sort of passive as an investor. But it's really important just to get those sort of plans and get the right people sort of like talking to you. And again, with that, you look at maybe a conveyancer, solicitor, accountant, and if you're time poor like I was back then, get a buyer's agent. And then the reason why having a good buyer's agent in your sort of case is that they'll sort of like, they know the good suburbs of relationships and they can generally buy quite well. So if I was starting again, first things I would do is set up that really strong team. And then the second thing is really kind of have a look at, once you've got an idea and your strategy, whether you're going to go a cash flow route or a capital growth route, then start trying to align those assets to that particular strategy. And so when you look around Australia at the moment, it's kind of not everything as you talk about a lot in your 2 cents podcast, Pete, not everything goes up at once. There's various sort of times in the property clock, if you will, where a city is at. And so Brisbane at the moment's doing well. Perth is going gangbusters. I mean, it's just crazy. But I'd kind of have a look at what sort of market I could put that in. And then it's just a case of getting in the market, taking action, and then just waiting and just extracting the equity out. At the moment, what we're seeing in Brisbane is, as you know, Pete, we talk about it quite a bit, apartments are doing well. It's not talked about. There's a certain type of apartment that's actually quite good value. So it's trying to find those sort of like asset class within the property space that will do well. Getting on there, taking action, getting that property, seeing how it goes in a couple of years, extracting the equity out, and then going again. But again, it's just doing the little things each day, the simple things, and just starting off. So can it be done? Of course it can. It's not easy, but every sort of journey starts with the first step. I can't remember what the quote is there, Pete, but yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I suppose it's probably one of those, it's almost fortune cookie, isn't it? It's the longest journey starts with the first step or something along those. But it's true. You just got to, I think in my experience, you'll find roadblocks along the way, and some things in life just don't work out as you plan. That's just the way it goes for every single person. I think even Charlie Munger said it. It's one of the cast iron rules is that something in your life, you'll face some hardships. That's the way it goes. Now, yeah, I mentioned before, these days you're a property strategist and a buyer's agent. I'll save you doing the plug. You can check out propertystrat.com.au and you can contact Stephen there. But Steve, you've given us, to wrap up, you've given us some idea of timeline there. So, you're talking about the best part of a couple of decades to build an eight-figure portfolio. But a couple of questions to wrap up. Firstly, how many sort of assets are you talking there to build that kind of portfolio? How many properties or investments? And then do you have any sort of mindset hacks for us? You mentioned a few sliding doors moments, but are there any sort of shifts in mindset or wealth mindset that people would need to make to sort of kickstart this kind of a journey?
Yeah, sure. No, there's two very good questions. I'll start with the first one. So I'm probably having a moment of panic. I think it's 13 properties that we've got. So, but the interesting thing with those properties, I was quite risk averse when I started out. Like what I said, I did the developments, but we kind of did a lot of our sort of estimations on one income. And so we also adopted a capital growth strategy with the property because I just wanted to get the principal place of residence sort of paid off. And being a nomad from the UK, I was able to sort of swap the cities as I talked about. But each time, for example, when Baulkham Hills doubled, like where we went to Melbourne, we lived within the means and we bought a property there in Mount Eliza at half the price just to reduce the debt. And again, when we came up to Brisbane, we could have bought, a very expensive property, but we wanted to have no debt. So we got that debt cleared out. So the reason why I'm talking about this as quickly is that we wanted to get the LVR quite reasonable towards that 50% mark. And when we were able to do that, that's when the exponential growth with the property happened. We sold the reservoir property, but we kept buying the medium style cash flow type properties. And that's really like the property portfolio grew from, I think it was from 4 to like the 13 in probably 3 years, just by good buying around that median. And sort of like, and that was our time. So we were our LVR when we started, I think it was 25%. And then we just ticked that up to about 60% by getting this big asset base. So it's really like what you're saying a little bit with Warren Buffett a second ago. Kind of all of his wealth was being made, or a lot of his wealth has been made in the last few years. That's kind of really the story of that property portfolio. And that's why it's important to stay the course and be patient. So it's a second question about sort of like kind of mindset hacks. I think, we put in the mention about Jan Summers' book, and it's really as simple as that. I don't think there's many more property books that you need to read. There's a few out there. Some of yours, Pete, of course. They're always good to look at. But a lot of what I sort of like work on now is kind of like those mindset sort of changes. And I think you got me onto a couple of books here, Pete. But so The Psychology of Money is a very good one by Morgan Housel. But I do a lot of personal development on mindset now. So it just that sort of growth mindset, but how you just keep going and you're proactive and you keep moving. And there's a couple of really good books, I think. Yeah. Okay. So that was it's just spoke about Morgan Housel's book being good. There's a couple of other books sort of, that I'd recommend. And then they're kind of more on mindset and growing the mindset, because as I said, with the Jan Summers stuff, the strategy is fairly straightforward. And there's two really good ones. There's one called The Slight Edge by Jeff Olson. And that's really just doing the little things each day. And that's not just with property. That's just with everything, sort of like health and fitness. It's the same sort of concept throughout. And it kind of, I suppose the book's a bit repetitive, but that's the whole point of it. And so that's a really good one. And then sort of like there's one by Stephen Bartlett, which is a Diary of a CEO. And that's kind of really just, again, a lot about mindset sort of shifts. And so I think those two books are just in, developing kind of like mindset are very important. And there's a real old one as well I'd like to put in, because I think that's really important when you're starting your property portfolio out. It's called The Richest Man in Babylon. And that's a really good one, because that's just simple finance advice. And it doesn't, I mean, and that's exactly what this is. It doesn't, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's really just kind of like earn money, sort of save more than you spend, and then invest that sort of like delta, if you will, into something that's going to give you income, and then just test or wait out and just let you, yeah, get the fruits of that sort of work. So I think those ones are sort of quite big, but something I've just keep trying to do is just keep working on that and keep on that proactive sort of mindset.
So talking to you through this, Steve, it sounds like for you, a lot of it is really quite simple in a sense. Start as young as you can, try and take a lifetime view of your portfolio. And do these days, do you think much about buying and selling, or are you just trying to build a snowball? Because I suppose with a lot of these strategies, where you're thinking 10, 15, 20 years ahead, you don't really know what the future brings. But I suppose, as you mentioned, the LVR naturally tends to fall away over time as you pay down debt and as the property portfolio increases. But I suppose the most important thing is to create the equity, so you've got all the choices. But what do you think about sort of trading properties, or are you more just sort of accumulating these days?
Yeah, well, I'm actually going to give yourself a bit of a hat tip here. So it was over.
You scored plenty of brownie points for doing that. So.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. So over a bit of a year ago, this is what I was wrestling with a little bit. And so, I've been working, quite long. I've been fairly successful in the career, but I wanted to take a bit more time with the family. And so trying to work out what I was going to do. And so I called you up, Pete, and just said, okay, this is my situation, and I got you to help me, mentor me a little bit throughout this period. And sort of like, we looked at it and we thought, well, okay, if we could sell down a few of these properties, trade the properties, as you just said, we might be able to sort of like realize X amount of income and then get some sort of cap, or sort of get some income on that, and then just retire. But I think you sort of provoked a little bit on some sort of questions about, well, why do that? What are you going to do? You can't play golf every day. Disclaimer, I love my golf. But then you lose that sort of compounding effect. So if you've got an eight-digit portfolio, and then you sort of sold half of it down, and what it does take away the risk, is that the right thing to do? And so we had a bit of a think about it. I remember a few conversations. And we thought the best thing to do was actually not do anything. I mean, there's sort of cash flow, after 14 rate rises, I think it is, was down about 30-40 grand a year. And so we just thought of ways of how we could mitigate that. And you were pretty influential for me, Pete, in sort of encouraging me to think outside the box and not be too conditioned to doing, the day job as we tend to be in England. So this is kind of like why I've decided to do what I'm doing now, just to sort of cater for that, because I want to keep that compounding effect, if anything, sort of grow it, because it's just so much fun. There's a bit of there's obviously a passion there, but again, keeping that compound effect, and especially with Brisbane. I still think there's a lot of value in Brisbane. I would say that, but with the Olympics coming and a lot of infrastructure, the city's changing year on year, so it's better. Having eight properties, I think it is, in Brisbane, it's better to keep them and not sell them down. And just a couple of things on that. I mean, okay, you can't do this. You can't look in the rearview mirror too much. But this is why property is such a good asset class. You can leverage up pretty safely. But if I look at our principal place of residence in Balcombe Hills, so we bought that for 685 in 2010. And we sold that in 2016, I think, for 1.3 million. We thought we were the smartest people in the room. We used this cash flow strategy. And don't get me wrong, that's amazing. That property is now valued at 2.1 million. So it's the time and waiting and using that sort of snowball effect to your portfolio. And that sort of like resonates quite strong with me. And I was so grateful for yourself and in changing that mindset in myself. And I think that's a good thing. It's good to connect to people who've done it, and that sort of life coach, wealth coach, or whatever it is. I'm not shamelessly plugging you here, Pete. I think it's just important to keep growing. I mean, golfers need professionals to help them with their swing. I mean, it's the same thing with this in growing your portfolio and growing your wealth. And
so, well, I definitely need some help with my golf swing, the way I'm hitting the fairways or not hitting the fairways at the moment. I did see on your bio you've played 55 of the world's top 100 golf courses. I don't know anyone who's got that far into the journey. Obviously, there's some tough ones still to go, like Augusta. But yeah, I think, as you said, there's two sides to this debate. Some people say just live your life in your 20s and mid early 30s, I guess, and just see, you know, find your passion, and then you can worry about real estate later on. I suppose the other way to think about it, and this is, I suppose, the way we've gone, is get yourself an asset base first, and then you can kind of choose what to do to earn some income, or, you know, but you can take the focus away from the income in the career and then focus on what you're passionate about, whether it's playing the top 100 golf courses or, you know, or finding something that relates to investing or just another career. But as you said, nobody's journey is going to be completely smooth. It's more just, just getting up from the setbacks and then just finding a way to keep going and to keep that compounding going. It's interesting. You do hear that story a lot about people who used to own something in Sydney, or they used to own this place in prime central London, and now they look back and think, oh, actually, it's worth a lot more today, which I suppose goes back to the point on compounding and taking a long-term view.
Yeah, exactly. I remember, I think you own one or two in Bondi, and just you imagine just selling those out maybe 2010 or whatever, or 2015. I mean, it's a pretty forgiving asset class, and it's been good. And someone has asked me quite a lot, why don't you invest in stock, and it's hard to diversify a little bit, but property's been pretty good. It's more, while it's investing, it's treating it like a business, and it's kind of, it's just been good with us. So at the moment, I'm pretty happy not diversifying and just letting things run its course. It's if anything, trying to get that sort of value up to sort of compound it even more.
It's an interesting point, actually, on the balanced portfolio, because almost invariably you find that people who invest in property end up, because of the leverage, they end up very top heavy in real estate, even though they might have shares and superannuation and business and other things. It's just the nature of the beast. But also, as the portfolio grows, you should find that even though you started out with an intention of a balanced portfolio, certainly that's been my experience, you end up top heavy in real estate, partly because of the performance, but mainly because of the leverage as well, I suppose. So, yeah, and as you said, there's other people like Chris Gray said the same thing. He just doesn't bother with the stock market now. He understands real estate. He's got high-performing assets that he understands how to manage. So he's not going to bother too much about the other side in stocks and shares. Maybe later on he will. But, as you said, you do tend to become focused on the asset class because of the leverage.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing we did have a look at was the Peter Thornhill strategy and what you could do. And I know Peter's very anti-property, and I do understand that sort of argument that he has. But to kind of look at, like, I mean, it's just fairly simple for me. If you kind of have a look at to accomplish what Peter Thornhill's done, and then just the disclaimer is it's just by index funds or LICs, and sort of put money away, that richest man in Babylon sort of theory. And then just keep pumping it into index funds. Yeah, I mean, you'll do well. I mean, it's a good strategy. Don't get me wrong. But you're probably going to be doing that for 30 odd years to, you know, and you still won't probably achieve the same sort of returns as you can do by
income. Yeah, it's an income focused as well investment. Yeah. You'll get more passive income sooner that way. And in fact, particularly in Australia with the high dividend yields that we have, and also the dividend. Dividend imputation, the franking credits, and the way the tax system is set up. But I often find that some people just have a preference for one or the other, and it's not necessarily even grounded in the numbers. It's just what feels more comfortable for them. And there's not to say that one way is right or the other way is better or whatever, but it's just find something that works for you and just keep going with it, I suppose.
Yeah, no. That wasn't a knock on the strategy. I think it's a very good one. There's a guy we used to work with. He's doing a similar sort of strategy, and he's been pretty successful with it. And but yeah, for for buying and sell property probably made a lot of sense. But as going back to something you said about sort of like it's just doing the simple things, just buying those properties where you can maybe add a bit of value to, maybe convert from a 3-bedroom, 1-bathroom to a 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom property, you know, in a decent place that has a decent rental return. I think it's as simple as that. And just letting time to think.
So I mentioned you can track down Stephen at propertystrats.com.au if you want to contact him and ask a bit more about his journey or how you can go about doing the same thing. So, Steve, thanks so much for your insights there. It's always fascinating to hear how people have progressed on the way. And what comes next for you on the top 100 golf courses? Have you got any on the hit list?
Over 45 to do. So yeah, I mean, I'd like to... I've got to get this approved by my wife, but I'd like to go out and play National Golf links in Shinnecock in New York later this year in Fisher's Island. I've got a long-standing sort of like invitation Cypress points at some point, but I wanted to leave that towards the end because that's the ultimate for me. But I think property is, I wouldn't be able to do this sort of like passion of mine if it wasn't for some of the property investing. So that's coming up. Also, maybe a trip to the UK to see my parents, maybe try to get a Royal County down in Ireland. So it's some pretty good places to have a go there.
Yeah, I'll probably need to save up for a few golf balls before I played Cypress Point, hitting that par 3 across the water there. Could see myself losing a few. So, I've lost enough here at Noosa Springs, to be honest. So, thanks so much, Stephen. It's great to chat and get all of your insights. And, look forward to speaking again soon.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Pete. And, have a good day.
Pleasure. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning into the Australian Property Podcast.
If you love the show, why not subscribe or leave us a review on Apple or Spotify?
And if you want to work with me, Amy, Pete, or Chris,
you'll find links in your podcast player to get in contact with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Australian Property Podcast. We're huge advocates of getting the right advice at the right time from the right people. That's why it's important to understand that this podcast episode contained general financial information only. It is not designed to be specific or personalized to your financial, tax, or legal situation. With property, the check sizes are pretty big, so it's important you get advice from a licensed and trusted professional before acting on the information you hear in RAS podcasts. Thanks again for listening. For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the RASC Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.